Okay, my goal, rather than to share with you very intricate and elaborate and developed ideas, is to share with you small pieces, small nuggets, and my hope is that they'll be food for thought, that you'll be able to expand on them, develop them, and think about them and talk about them over the course of your Seder. To the extent you're interested, I'm of course happy to talk about them in more depth with you after this class. But we're going to move quickly, and I hope to share with you a number of thoughts that will be relevant to your Seder. Okay. First, the thought on Magid itself. You'll notice that Magid seems a little haphazard. We're quoting a pasuk, and we're quoting a medrash, and we're singing a song, and we're lifting our cup, and we're pointing to a matzah. Is there an order to Magid? Of course, there's an internal order, there's a seder to the evening as a whole, but what about an internal order to Magid? I'd like to suggest that there are really three sections, of Magid. The first is a narrative section. The first is a story. We tell the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We tell people who tell about the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it's modeled for people who are receptive to hearing and listening to and engaging in stories. Then we cap that. Section by saying Baruch Shomer Haftachaso, a blessing to Hashem, and then we move on. Then we start darshaning psukim. There's all kinds of exegesis. We quote a pasuk and we talk about it at length. And that part of the Magid section is really scholarship. It's really intense Talmud Torah. And that part of the Seder ends with Dayenu. Again, you know that it's the end because we sing a praise to Hashem. And finally, there's a third part of the Seder, and that's where we start doing some visual aids. We say, oh, Pesach, why do we do Pesach? And Matzah, why do we do Matzah? And Maror, why do we do Matzah? And again, it's to recognize that people learn in different ways. If the first part of the story, the Seder relates to people who engage in stories, and the second relates to people who engage in scholarship. The third is to speak to the visual learner, the one who's going to engage in a presentation. Here's a physical object. Let's talk about it. And of course, that section ends with Lefikach. Again, we're done with the section. We cap it off by singing out the praise of Hashem. I want to return to a theme that I've talked about in the past and develop it a step further. We dip twice at the Seder. We actually ask a question about dipping twice in the Manishtan, and we never explicitly answer it. Why do we dip twice? Well, we're left hanging. The answer is really because we're trying to create the bookends to the Exodus story. The story of Yetzias Mitzrayim began with the dipping of Yosef's coat by the brothers in blood. That led to the story of Joseph going down to Egypt, and that one thing led to the next, the domino effect, and the brothers followed, and eventually we became slaves in Egypt. And of course, the dipping is the bookend at the other end. The very last thing we do on the doorstep to our Exodus is we dip the Agudas Ezov, the hyssop bundle, into the blood of the Paschal Lamb. We daub it on the doorposts, and then we make our way out of Egypt. You know, if you want to know what day Tisha B'Av is going to fall out, it's very easy to know. You don't need to look on the calendar. You just figure out what day the first day of Pesach is, and you know the first day of Tisha B'Av. It always works out. Without looking at a calendar, I can tell you that Pesach, the Tisha B'Av this year, the first day will be a Tuesday, because it's always the same as the first day of Pesach. There are many connections. We won't get into them right now, but there are many connections between Pesach and Tisha B'Av. We have an egg on the Seder plate. One of the symbolisms of the egg is it's the food of the mourner. It's the food that a mourner eats when he or she comes home from the cemetery. And we're remembering the absence of the temple. It's a zecher, l'chorban. The temple has been destroyed, and we're saddened by that reality. The Pesach Tisha B'Av connection. I'm bringing this up in the context of the two dippings because there's also a hope or an aspiration that we'll be able to undergo a transformation. What's characterized by the animosity of the brothers toward Yosef? That's the Sinas Chinam, that's the Tisha B'Av aspect. We have a day on the calendar that's devoted to that challenge, to that problem, to that tragic to that tragic trait of the Jewish people, brothers who are not able to get along. That's the first dipping, that's the Tisha B'Av. We hope to move past it, to move forward through the mitzvos of the evening to the second dipping, and there's another symbolism, because what's the bundle hyssop called? An agudas ezov. It looks like, if you want to imagine what hyssop looks like, it looks like a broomstick, the bottom of a broomstick, or a paintbrush, and you would tie it all together such that it would function like a brush. You have to take the disparate pieces, the fractiousness, the friction, the brothers who aren't getting along, literally or figuratively, tie them all together, and that is the prerequisite for redemption. That is the prerequisite for turning exile into redemption. Let me talk for a second about Manishtana, just a very brief thought, and that is why do we ask four questions on Seder night? You could ask four questions on Sukkot. You could ask four questions on Shavuos. You could ask four questions on any Jewish holiday. There are lots of things that we wonder about and want to ask about. And I once saw a comment by Rabbi Riskin that I thought was very profound. He says, you know, On any other Jewish holiday, we understand and embrace our sense of exile. We are unredeemed. Because that's the natural state of the Jew. More of our history has been in galus than in a state of redemption. On Seder night, when we act like royalty and we make it out as though we're free and we've been redeemed, it says that's the state that requires a question, because that is an aberration from the norm. Exile, galus, is the normal state. When we're pretending for a moment that we've been redeemed, that is irregular, and that requires our attention. Okay, let me talk for a second about the Russia. You know, the Russia. The question is, why are we so tough on the Russia? Why do we knock out his teeth and we get so angry at him, and we give him this harsh line that if you were there, you wouldn't have been redeemed? So, two thoughts, just two comments, quickly about the Russia. One is we say that he separates himself from the Klal. He separates himself from the Jewish people, and therefore he's knocked down. So the word that we use to describe in the Haggadah is atzmo, which sometimes refers in Shas, in the Talmud, to Hashem. Atzmo is sometimes a euphemism for Hashem himself. So what we're saying is that not that the Russia takes himself out of the Klal, but that he takes Hashem out of the picture. He doesn't mention Hashem in his formulation of the question. That separates him from the other children, that separates him from the Chacham. Again, we've talked about this in the past, but you know, there's a need for us to recognize the place of Hashem in all of this, and of course to recognize the place of Hashem in our own lives. The second comment I want to make about the Russia is we say to him, Ilu Hayasham lo hayanigal, if he were there, he would not have been redeemed. So what's the force of that sentence? Why are we saying that, and what does that mean? I want to share with you a comment of the Shibalei Haleket, who says that it's really a midah keneged midah, that God works in a tit for tat, in a measure for measure kind of way. He says something which I think is very profound and has many resonances. Again, I'm just going to mention it and then move past it, but it's worth dwelling on. And that is, if you don't believe in Geula, you're not redeemed. We're not critiquing him by saying, oh, you're such a bad guy that if you were there, you wouldn't have merited to be redeemed. It's just a simple observation, which is, if you buy into the faith of redemption, if you buy into the notion of redemption, so then you are capable of being redeemed. It says you're one of the group, and then you could come with the group when we get out. But if you disavow that very notion, if you don't subscribe to the notion of redemption in and of itself, then when the redemption happens, well, you're not part of it, because you excluded yourself from the team. So that's essentially what we're saying about the Russia. You know, by excluding yourself, there are consequences. And one of those consequences is, we're just telling you, when redemption happened a long time ago, only those who believed in redemption were redeemed. And again, in the 21st century, as we hope for future redemption, it's only those who subscribe to the notion of redemption who will be redeemed. This is speculation that I just wanted to mention in passing. you know, we kind of let the Egyptians off pretty easy at the Seder. We mention a couple of psukim about how they were abusive to us, but we really don't dwell on it. And I'd like to suggest that we only mention the dastardly acts of the Egyptians to the extent that it helps explain the salvation that Hashem performed for us, to the extent that they enslaved us. So that is the extent to which we can appreciate how we were redeemed. But essentially, we refrain from going down the path which would be quite natural. Someone is describing their captors, so they'll embellish and say, oh, they were so terrible, and this is what they did, and they oppressed us, and they abused us. And we do that to a very circumscribed degree at the Seder. And I just wanted to suggest, tie this into a medrash, that says one of the reasons, one of the merits in which the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt, you know, the medrash, they kept their language, and they kept their clothes, and so on. One of the nuschaos in that medrash is that they've refrained, the Jewish people, the Israelites in Egypt, refrained from speaking Lashon Hara. They guarded their tongues from character assassination. That wasn't their way, even though it would have been very easy for them to devolve into that trait. And perhaps we're mimicking that at the Seder. Just as our ancestors restrained themselves and tried to put a limit on the extent to which they spoke ill of their enemies and their captors, we do the same thing. We do the same thing at the Seder. Okay, let me just wrap up with two last points. One is a global point on questions. You know, the Gemara and then the Rambam recapitulates this, says something quite fascinating, and it frames the whole evening. The Gemara says the following: Chacham b'no shoalo, v'im eino chacham ishto shoalto. Says, you know, every Seder conversation is going to happen based on the participants, based on who's around. If you have a son who's wise, then the son could ask questions. If there's no son around, then a person's spouse could ask the questions. And then the Gemara says something striking, which is v'im lav hu shoel la'atzmo. If there's no one to ask, or if a person is spending Seder night by themselves, hu shoel la'atzmo. He asks himself the question. Now, I would say that if no one else is around, and I start having a conversation with myself, then I might be accused of being a little schizophrenic. I mean, we have some people in the psychology world in the room. Does that sound normal, to start asking questions to oneself? It sounds a little odd. It sounds a little bizarre. Why is it so necessary to make this the ethic, to make questioning the ethic of the evening, that even if one is by himself, he asks questions? I wanted to suggest that we're so intent on making questions the theme of the night because questions themselves convey the very duality that we're describing at the Seder. They represent chayrus and freedom, in as much as only the free person is truly free to ask questions. But at the same time, and this is a subtle point, but at the same time, they point to a sense of avdus, in as much as the one asking the question implicitly relies on someone else for the answer. To put it differently, the form of the Seder matches its substance. Thematically, we toggle constantly back and forth between slavery and freedom. The text of the Haggadah and our matzah, which is the same thing, it's both the poor man's bread and the bread of redemption, follow suit, and it's no wonder then that the very style of our discussion fits the self-same pattern as the rest of the evening. Let me conclude with one final medrash, and then I'm going to turn things over to my distinguished colleagues. There's a medrash that says the following: why do we recline? Why do we recline on Seder night? Anyone know? Classic answer, why do we recline? Okay, this is something to do with the Romans, for sure. Classic answer is derecherus, royalty. We're so free that we're even able to recline. A king, queen reclines, and so do we. Medrash says something quite radical and quite different. To understand why it is that we recline at the Seder, it quotes the pasuk at the beginning of Parshas Bishalach, and the Medrash says, "Vayasev Elokim es ha'am." Vayasev Elokim es ha'am, Derech Hamidbar Yam Suf. What's the context of that pasuk? It's a pasuk of the beginning of Beshalach, which says that Hashem didn't take the people. It was a direct route. It could have taken the people from Egypt to the Promised Land, but instead He took them circuitously, vayasev, right from the word seviva, right around. Took them in a circuitous route. Now listen to the Medrash. Mikan Amar Rabbi Seinu. From here, the rabbis derived afilu ani shbi Yisrael lo yochol ad sheyesei. Person should not participate in the Seder until they recline. Even a poor person, everyone has to act like royalty. Everyone has to recline because Hashem took the Jewish people in a circuitous route. I'd like to just wrap up this section by sharing one observation, and that very simply is the notion that I think this Medrash is trying to convey, and that is redemption is not predictable. It can happen at any moment. And when it does, it won't be linear. It's not going to happen in a straight line. Vayaseh, if it's circuitous, it's roundabout, it's complicated, and it's a message that speaks directly to our generation. There are many applications, but one is Israel. So what does it mean? 1948, we have Israel, but we don't have the temple. We have sovereignty, but how do we maintain the Jewish character of the state? We're in Israel, but half the world's Jewish population isn't living there. Who knows if we can make sense of all of it? That's redemption. It's circuitous, and it's unpredictable, and our redemption is incomplete. But Dayenu, the extent to which we enjoy the redemptive brachos in our lives warrants our giving thanks to our Creator, who is also our Redeemer. On that note, I want to turn things over to Rabbi Ari Lapp.
Good evening, everybody. What I'd like to do with you this evening is two things. I'd like to deconstruct it totally, thematically and substantively separate, but just to structure the evening and outline it, I'd like to deconstruct a well-worn question with which we've all been confronted at one point or another over the course of our Siddurim. And then second, I'd like to propose an insight into a section of the Haggadah that I hope will be new, that I hope will be new to you, and then see what we can do with it. Number one, I've labeled this section one on the handout that's going around. I've given you just as a prototype of the typical Ashkenazic and contemporary Sephardic text of the Haggadah that we have nowadays. I've given you a quote from the Rambam's Haggadah that he appends to the end of Hilchos Chametz Umatzah. And this contains the beginning of, or the first half of the pericope dealing with the four children and the questions that the four children ask, the wise one, the evil one, and so on and so forth. And I'd like to just quickly run through it, and then we'll note the obvious textual disturbance. Chacham Mahu Omer, Maha Eidos V'Achukim V'Amishpatim Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem, Afata Emor Lo K'Hilchos HaPesach, Ein Maftir Nachar Pesach HaFikomen. What does the wise child say? What are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments with the Lord which the Lord our God has commanded you? You should, and so in response to this question, you should surely teach the wise son all the ordinances of the Passover until the very end of the Mishnah. Do not serve HaFikomen dessert after the Paschal Lamb. In other words, the child is asking, what are these things that we do on Pesach? At least that's the way the pasuk is interpreted in the Haggadah, and we respond to him by teaching him about all of the laws that pertain to Pesach. Then we transition to the polar opposite of the wise child, the wicked child. Rasha Mahu Omer, Maha Avodah Hazos Lachem. Lachem velo lo. Lafisha hotzi es atzvo min haklal kafar beikar. Afeta hakeya shina ve'amor lo ba'avor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzei simim mitzrayim li velo lo v'ilo hayasham lo hayonigal. What does the wicked child say? What is this service? What is this ritual to you? For you? You, he says, and not himself. And since he takes himself out of the body of the people, the collective body of Am Yisrael, he denies a basic principle of faith, and therefore you must blunt his sharp teeth. Hakeh doesn't mean knock out his teeth. It's in, as in the pasuk in Koheles, im keha habarzel v'hulo fanim kilkal. If the iron is blunted and you haven't sharpened the edge, so you blunt his teeth. He's trying to be sharp and chutzpedik, so you respond in kind and you say, all of this is because of that which the Lord did unto me when I came forth from Egypt. For if he had been there, the wicked child, he would not have been redeemed. Now, the phraseology that we have here in this version of the Rambam's Haggadah begs an obvious question, with which everybody is familiar. The wise child, rather the wicked child, is castigated, is taken to task for asking, what is all of this to you? As if he is prescinding from the proceedings of the evening and simply speaking as if he's not part of the Jewish people. Ah, but what's the problem? What does the wise child do? He asks also, what are all of these things to you? Eschem, what are you doing this evening? How do we resolve this seeming contradiction? I'd like to propose that, although the Rishonim offer many beautiful and insightful answers, I'd like to propose one that I think is at least to me, the most convincing. I hope you'll find it so as well. Take a look at source number 2. I've given you on the top left-hand corner there a fragment from the newly digitized collection of the Cairo Geniza. It's wonderful. You can access it now on your iPhone. Just be sure to cite the very confusing and impenetrable shelving number. The fragment that I've given you here is from a very old Haggadah of the Babylonian Nusach of the Haggadah, which we use to this very day. And if you look at the very top, it begins with the Chacham's question. Chacham Mahu Omer? And then what's that next word? Osanu. And he puts a kamatz under the tuf, just so that you can make sure to know that that's how the word should be pronounced. What are all of these laws and so on, and statutes and testimonies to us? Now the drasha makes sense. The question of the Chacham is, what are all of these things to us? And he includes himself among the Jewish people, whereas the wicked child excludes himself from Klal Yisrael. And in fact, if you look at the version of the Midrash of the four children that is present in the Mechilta, in one of the early Midrashei Halacha, you'll see a similar, on the right hand side, you'll see a very similar textual version. Chacham Mahu Omer, Mahaidos v'Hachukim v'Hamishpatim Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Osanu. This seems to have been the original version of the Chacham's question. Now, what's the obvious taxing theological problem with this? Where is the Chacham's question derived from? Is it something that the Baal Haggadah made up? He derives it from a pasuk. It's a pasuk in Devarim, Perek Vav. And the version of the pasuk that, if you open your chumash right now, that you would see is Ma'idos v'achukim v'amishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu eschem. The original wording of the pasuk, as we have it in our chumash, is eschem. So, if the entire edifice of this midrash is built on a different version of the pasuk, how could that be? So, in fact, if you take a look at the source below that, in the comments at the very end of the Frankel Rambam to the Rambam's version of the Haggadah, there is a notice that, in fact, even the Rambam himself, who obviously had the version of the Chumash that we have in front of us, has the following girsa. You take a look at this source in the bottom. It says, "Eschem be'etz chayim uvedfusim yishanim osanu v'chein hu b'mechelta v'Yerushalmi." He points out that the original version of the Rambam, when it was printed, also read osanu. It didn't read eschem. The Rambam as well had the girsa osanu. What are these statutes and laws and so on to us? The wise child includes himself amongst the nation of Israel. And then he explained, this commentary goes on to explain, V'eino kein b'pasuk, this is not the version that we have of the pasuk that we have in our Chumashim. However, V'chasav ha'pnei Moshe, one of the great commentators on the Yerushalmi or Moshe Margalit, also distinguishes one of the only achronim to have ever received a bachelor's degree in botany. He writes as follows, Mishana ben Chacham v'shoel shelo lehotzi atzmo min haklal. In fact, the Chacham changed the pasuk. He knew what the pasuk was, of course, obviously. He amended the wording of the pasuk to reflect that he was including himself among the people sitting around the Pesach table, when the Seder table, when he asked this question. Okay, that's one plausible read, I think, of the way that the Haggadah structures this midrash. It's certainly one plausible reading. I think it's meaningful in and of itself. I'd like to suggest one more. Take a look at that next source, then we'll move on. There's a famous Tosfos in Shabbos, and appended to this Tosfos is the longest Gilyon HaShas by Rabbi Akiva Eiger in all of Shas. And Tosfos, in a completely different context, makes the following comment for which Tosfos has become justly famous, and that is, HaShas Shalanu Cholek Al Svarim Shalanu. There are occasions when Chazal seem to have had a different version of the Chumash than we have in our modern Chumashim. They simply disagree about what the text of the Chumash should be. This, I would submit, is one of those cases. How do we know that it's one of those cases? Because there are several ancient versions of the Bible that have the version Osanu. I've given you one on the right-hand side. The Septuagint, which is from the 3rd century before the Common Era. It shall come to pass when your son shall ask you tomorrow, saying, what are the testimonies, statutes, and judgments which the Lord our God has commanded, Emin, has commanded us. It clearly had the word Osanu. What does this mean? So as the Gilyon HaShas goes on to explain when he comments on Tosfos, there are times, just as Chazal scrutinized every single phrase of every single halacha that was passed down by a Torah Shebaal Peh, so too Chazal scrutinized each and every single letter, kal v'chomer, of the Torah Shebichsav, of the written Torah, and occasionally, as people are wont to do, they argued about what the proper wording should be, and these machlokos are sometimes preserved for us, these disputes are sometimes preserved for us in the Gemara. Now, to the extent that there is a moral to this story, I would submit that it is this. We preserve the, although it doesn't seem to make much sense in the context of the Midrash, we preserve the wording of the Chumashim that we have. And the reason this is so is because just as when it comes to Psak Halacha, when it comes to legal decisions that are rendered in the realm of Halacha and Torah Sheba'al Peh, we may have disputes among the early authorities, but at the end of the day, the one that our community and that our poskim accept, we are bound by, and we don't get to go back and choose, pick and choose which early authorities we like when the fancy takes us. So too, when it comes to the textual version of the Torah Shebichsav that we have received, we don't get to pick and choose which early versions we like and which we don't like. The version that our Masorah, that our tradition has preserved for us, is the one that binds our community. In times such as these, when this very point of with respect to the halakhic process is the subject of discussion, I think it would do well for us to recall, in the context of the Haggadah, when we read this, that the version that our Chumash has preserved for us is the one that has dominated and the one that has survived for us over the course of these centuries. Now, turning to another, I hope, less familiar topic, and that is in the context of Dayenu. Dayenu is a very, and with this we'll conclude, Dayenu is a very strange, not strange, but a very remarkable piyut. It appears only later on in some of the Babylonian versions of the Haggadah. It doesn't appear in any of the early versions that were in use in Eretz Yisrael. And what I'd like to ask, therefore, is what is the function of Dayenu? Dayenu would not have been inserted willy-nilly into the text of our Haggadah just because it's an entertaining song with an entertaining tune. So the question is, what is the function of Dayenu? Now, here's my question. Dayenu begins with the following phrase: Kama ma'alos tovos lamakom aleinu. The following wonderful things God has done for us. The word ma'alos tovos, the phrase ma'alos tovos, wonderful things God has done for us. Now, where is the phrase ma'alos in the context of Dayenu? What should that remind us of? Now, how many things? Yes. Regalim. Oh, excellent, fantastic. That is exactly what should remind us of. Shir HaMa'alos. Now why? Now other than the fact that the two words are the same, Ma'alos Tavos and Shir HaMa'alos, the 15 songs of ascent in the Psalms, what is the commonality between the Dayenu and the Shir HaMa'alos, and the Shiyare HaMa'alos, or the Shire rather HaMa'alos? The answer is, if you count up the number of wonderful things that are said to have occurred to the Jewish people in Dayenu, you will find that the number is, in fact, 15. There are 14 lines, and the first one contains two. Ilo hotzianu mimitzrayim v'lo asa v'hem shifatim. There are 15 ma'alos, tovos, that are said to have, or that for which we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the context of Dayenu. Now there is another context, I think, that we are meant, those who are sensitive to rabbinic literature, that are meant to recall right away when we think of 15 ma'alos. The 15 ma'alos of Dayenu, and that is, take a look at the following Mishnah. Chasidim va'anshei ma'asa hayu meraktim lifneihem ba'avukos shel orish biyadehen va'omrim lifneihem divrei shiros v'tushpachos. On the night after the first night of Sukkos, the very first night after we finished everything that we're supposed to do on the first night of Sukkos, we have the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. We have the ceremony where the Kohanim go down to to the spring just beneath Yerushalayim, and they bring up water to use in the Nisach HaMayim, in the water libation ceremony that is meant to transition us into a state of revelry and a state of happiness in the course of the holiday of Sukkot. Now, how would this processional occur? So everybody would be dancing around the Levim as they went down, as they prepared, and the Kohanim prepared, to get the water of the Nisach HaMayim. What would happen? V'halivim b'kinaros v'nivalim v'mitzaltayim v'chatzatzros v'klei shir below mispar al chamesh esrei ma'alos hayordos me'ezras Yisrael ezras nashim keneged chamisha asar shir ha'ma'alos shebetilim shaleim levim omdim klei shir v'omrim shira. The Levim would stand at the top of the 15 stairs, the 15 ma'alos, which corresponded, the Mishnah explicitly tells us, to the 15 shirei ha-ma'alos, the 15 psalms that begin shir ha-ma'alos, in one case shir la-ma'alos, in Tehillim. And this is how the revelry of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva would be kicked off. Now, what's the lesson here? The function that the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, as some of the Achronim have pointed out, serves in the context of Sukkot is as follows. It helps us transition from the first day of festivities in Sukkot to the rest of the days of the festivities of Sukkot. Simchas Beis HaShoeva lasts, of course, several days, but it transitions from the beginning of Sukkot, the first day, till the end. Now, what's the difference between the first day and the rest of Sukkot? The answer is as follows. The obligation to take the Arba Minim, the four species, applies to everybody, anywhere, on the first day of Sukkot. But for the duration of Sukkot, it seems to have applied only in the Beis HaMikdash. So what the Simchas Beis HaShoeva does is it helps us via a grand, but of course modest and becoming celebration, to transition from that period of celebration on Sukkot, wherein we are all, wherever we may be, Jews who are serving together as part of the Jewish nation, to a nation that exists solely within the context of the Beis HaMikdash, exists solely within the context of the Temple. The first day, we have the Lulav and Esrog and the Arba Minim wherever we are. And the rest of Sukkot, we only do so in the context of the Beis HaMikdash. And the holiday focuses exclusively on what occurs in the Beis HaMikdash. So too, I think, in the Haggadah. Just before Dayenu is when we conclude the portion of the Maggid that focuses upon the story, the narrative of the Exodus, the saga of the Exodus. We begin with the degradation of our people in times of old, and we continue all the way until the glory of the Exodus and the escape from Egypt. As soon as that story concludes, we have Dayenu, and then what comes subsequently, what comes immediately after Dayenu, what do? Rabbi Gamliel HaYaomer, we have to say three things and recall three things in the context of the Pesach meal. As the Rambam points out, and as Rabbi Levine pointed out in his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, this is exactly the point where, had these been temple times, we would have begun to prepare for eating the Karban Pesach and beginning our sacrificial meal. So Dayenu marks the point where, in an ideal world, we transition from a mitzvah that anybody can perform anywhere, Haggadah, Magid, the Higadata Levincha, to a meal, a ritual, that is limited to temple Jews, to Jews in the context of their land, in the times of the Geula, at least from now on. And so what Dayenu does is the same thing as the Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkot. It takes us from an ethnicity, from a nation, from a people that are boundless, that don't respect national boundaries, that can worship God wherever they may be, to a people that require a land and a temple. In short, Eretz Yisrael. So in the context of this Pesach, before I turn things over to my colleagues, my prayer is that this Pesach, we will use the Dayenu to help us focus upon what's important, and that is, as much as it is a privilege, as much as it was miraculous for us to have been taken out of Egypt and given the Torah that can sustain us in all of the countries to which we may be exiled over the course of time, ultimately our hearts and minds are pointed inexorably and irrevocably towards the Holy Land, towards Eretz Yisrael, and eventually b'mehera bi'ameinu, the Beit HaMikdash. So I'll turn things now over to Chaz.
Why did we end up with this version?
Why with Eschem? So at a certain point, the Baalei HaMasora, the authoritative poskim of the version of the textual body of the Tanakh, essentially paskin that Eschem would be the girsa that we have. The fact that this version, Osanu, creeps into the Mechilta and eventually creeps into the Rambam is a quirk of history, essentially. But the way that, just as Psak Halacha, in the context of Torah Sheba'al Peh, and also Torah Sheba'chsav for that matter, we refer to the Shulchan Aruch, we refer to the Ramah, when it comes to the Psak Halacha, as it were, in matters of the text of the Tanakh, we refer to the Baalei HaMasora of the 10th century in Tveria. And that is essentially what governs us authoritatively to this very day.
Good evening, everybody. Shis Smardasra. To say, I always find it very inspiring that people come to learn before Pesach. You know, people have a lot to do. I myself take a lot of chizik from it. Should just be one with the bag. So there's a question that we have in a free society, which is that people have a lot of choices, maybe more choices than they ever did, and how exactly are we going to transmit the Masorah to the next generation? It's a very fair question. Nobody has any perfect answer. But I think it's always a mistake to try to suggest that Yahadus is user-friendly, or that it's easy. Because of the various life systems that I could imagine, I'm not familiar with everything from personal experience, I'm obviously most familiar with Yadus, and I'm grateful for that. It seems to me one of the hardest. It's extremely demanding, it requires tremendous personal discipline, it requires enormous sacrifice of every kind. Men and women have different obligations, but there's a certain common denominator, which is that it's very demanding. I always think it's a mistake to present Yahadus in light of some kind of a user-friendly modality, or that this is somehow, in a short term, what's most pleasurable. Obviously, over the long term, I think there's so much that it offers us. And that's exactly what I wanted to discuss with you very briefly tonight, and to begin with some sukkim in Sefer Dvarim. Moshe Rabbeinu, in the last 37 days of his life, said Sefer Dvarim, and he begins with a certain sentiment of perhaps just how demanding Yahadus can be. So now, O Jewish people, what does Hashem ask from you? So you would think that the pasuk would say something like, let's say Josh was here for Shabbos, right? So if Arthur had said to Josh before Shabbos, Josh, what do I ask from you? You come on time, you come with clean clothes, that would be reasonable. So you'd expect a pasuk like that, right? But that's not what you get. You get the opposite. All I'm asking is, liyiras Hashem Elokech, you should fear me. Lelechas b'chol drachav, you should follow every single one of my ways. Lavo, so you should love your God. Right? This is like a very ambitious list, but we're not done. Right, you're supposed to serve God with all of your heart and with all of your soul. And to keep all of the mitzvos. So that's not so easy. That's not like a small request. And something that we say every day, twice a day, not including Kriyat Shema Lamita, not including the Korbanos, maybe up to four times a day. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. So there is one God. But you know what that means for us? V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha. We have to love God intensely, intensively and intensely, in a totally self-sacrificing way. Again, just simply based on this psukim, the Gemara, in so many different places, Psachim Chavhei, Sanhedrin's Ayin Dalid, and others, says that we have to be prepared to sacrifice our life for God. It's very demanding. Not only that, you should carry the words of the Torah not in your pocket, not in your briefcase, not in your school bag, but in your heart. God demands your whole heart. Vishinantam levanecha, and you're supposed to teach your children in a way that they could even master it. Shinun. Vidibar tabam, and you should, and your children should, speak in matters of Torah. You know when? Not once a week. Not when the Spirit moves you, but b'shivtecha b'veisach, lachtecha v'derech, v'shachbecha v'kumecha, in a word, always. Always. I'm asking everything. And not only that, but everything plus. Then I want you to tie these ideas to your very body, and your arm, and your head. And if you could forget them, just put them on every single doorway. So it's totally immersive. It's totally intensive. The approach is very demanding and extremely rigorous. So this is true year-round, but I always think that it's especially the case when it comes to Pesach. Pesach, the level of demand in terms of what's required from us, not just in terms of eradicating our chametz, but preparing for the sedarim, changing our diets. Pesach, this idea of total demand, has a very prati dimension to it. And indeed, one finds in so many different ways the notion of immersion when it comes to Pesach all over Chazal. Let me just try to show you a number of different examples and then explain how I think this adds up and what we can take from it this year at our Sedarim. So of course, we're familiar with the, I think Rabbi Lam mentioned it, Rabbi Levine also mentioned it. I guess the Rasha is getting a lot of media tonight. So I'll just quote from the Yerushalmi. We're familiar with the Maha Avoda Hazos Lachem Rasha, but the Yerushalmi says something a little bit different. What's the issue of the Rasha? Rasha Mahu Omer, Maha Avoda Hazos Lachem, Maha Tircha Hazos She'ata Toreach Aleinu B'chol Shana V'shana. What's this burden? This is an enormous tumult. It's an enormous to-do. It's a Tircha. So the Rasha turns to his father, to his teacher, to his mother, whoever it is, and says, why this tircha? Why do you have such a demanding approach? Isn't it enough to love God? Isn't it enough that I should feel it in my heart? What is this tircha? And the Rush is not wrong in terms of his observation. We just think that he's drawn the wrong conclusion. It is, if you come at it from either a cynical point of view or just what we think is a little bit of a negative point of view, maybe, it does seem like a tircha. Again, Yahadus doesn't pretend to be user-friendly in the colloquial sense of the term. So the Rasha asks, Maha Tircha? And indeed, you take a look at the Gemara in Pesachim Daf Vav, Gemara says, Sholim v'dorshim b'hilchos ha-Pesach, kodem ha-Pesach shloshim yom. That the halachos of Pesach are so intensive that a 30-day preparatory period is required. Now, it is true that the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Hei suggests that this is just because the Karban Pesach itself had so many little details and so many potential mumin invalidations that this was required, especially for the Karban Pesach. But another way of looking at it is it's not just the Karban Pesach and it's not just preparatory, but basically what Chazal were after is Chazal were advocating a very immersive approach. They were advocating and saying it's actually important to immerse yourself in this even 30 days before. And this notion of immersion obviously comes to a head in certain lashonos of Chazal when it comes to Seder night itself. We're all familiar from our Haggadah with the idea of kol hamar belasaper b'yitzias Mitzrayim harezim meshubah. Right, that increasing one's telling of the story is praiseworthy. And then the Haggadah tells the story of Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva, and they stayed up all night. They stayed up all night to talk about Yitzias Mitzrayim. And not only that, but the Tosefta says that Chayev Adam, not Lilmod, but La'asok Behilchos HaPesach Kolos HaLaila. A different tradition, not Yitzias Mitzrayim, not to tell the story, but to learn the halachos, the nitty-gritty halachos of Karban Pesach all night long. And Rabbi Gamliel followed this tradition. Rabbi Gamliel and his base medrash would stay up all night, the Tosefta says, to learn the halachos of Karban Pesach. Again, immersive in the approach. The Rambam was Mechadesh, a third category. We know that the Mishnah says you're supposed to be Doresh Barami Ovedavi. So the Rambam says, Kol hamosif umarich bedrash parsha zo hareza mishubach. A third category of hosafa v'haracha. We have Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. We have Hilchos HaPesach all night. And then, of course, you have the Rambam in Arami Oved Avi. There's this idea, and when you couple that with the Shloshim Yom Kodem HaChag, a tremendous immersion. We're not running away from the Rasha's question of Ma'atircha, Shatam Matrecha. And we're saying, even more than that which is required by the letter of the law. We want to go more, we want to go further. So, if you take a look at the Chacham's question, which again was referenced before, so I think the Chacham understood, let's say he appreciated the same set of facts that the Rasha did, but he at least opened himself to a different perspective altogether, whether it was Eschem or Osanu. Either way, right, the Chacham, the word before that is critical, because the Chacham said, as Rabbi Lam noted, the Chacham says, Hashem Elokeinu, either way, he's our God. The Chacham has already included himself either way. So the Chacham says the following. The Chacham notes that it's a very intensive process, and that Yahadus writ large, and Pesach in particular, very demanding. So the Torah tells us the following: Ki yishalcha vincha machar lemor, mahaedos vehachukim vehamishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu, our God, eschem or osanu, as the case may be. So what's the Chacham saying? There are edos, there are chukim, there are mishpatim. There are so many laws. There are so many laws. So the Rasha looked at that set of facts and called it what? A tircha. So hard. But the Chacham said there must be some reason for it. Must be after something. So indeed, we answer the Chacham, we tell them the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim, and then we say the following. Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Vayitzavenu Hashem lasos, not as hachukim ha'ela, but as kol hachukim ha'ela. You know what? In immersion itself, in a rigorous approach, in a demanding approach, in something which isn't easy, which requires years and decades, and an abiding commitment to master, the yield is so much greater than it would ever be if we tried to make dilute it and make it user-friendly. The point is never dilution. Ambition always is the name of the game. What happens? Lasos es kol achukim ha'ela liyira es Hashem Elokeinu. Because when you have kol achukim ha'ela, when you have a demanding system, when you have something that asks a lot of us, that creates a relationship between us and Hashem that could have never existed if the name of the game was always taking a shortcut. We know about it from life. We don't get Beethoven or Brahms or Rembrandt or any greatness or excellence, something that's truly worthwhile, by taking shortcuts. So the Eidos and the Chukim and the Mishpatim, it's very hard in the short term. The Rasha looks at it as a tircha, but that's not really our approach. We actually run towards the rigor. Chayav Adam Lasok Bilchos HaPesach Kos HaLayla. Chayav Adam Lasaper B'Yitzias Mitzrayim Reza Mishubach. The more that you can do. And that's not something we should be embarrassed about or apologize for, that Yahadus is demanding. That's something we should embrace and we should be extremely proud of, that we have a very demanding system that requires much of us, but in the long term gives us so much back. Moshe Rabbeinu says, V'atem hadveikim b'Hashem Elokeichem chayim kolchem hayom. When you can be medavek b'Hashem, when you can truly cleave to Hashem, which is not the result of a casual approach or a half-hearted approach, or you do religion one day a week, maybe, but V'atem hadveikim b'Hashem Elokeichem, when you can cleave to Hashem through the most rigorous and intensive and demanding approach possible, chayim kolchem hayom, your life, the very quality of life, goes up. Why? Ki migoy gadol asher lo elokim kirovim elav, kashem elokeinu bechol kareinu elav. When we truly feel close to God, it's something unique about us, that we have a God who's oh so close to us. Umi goy gadol asher lo chukimu mishpatim tzadikim kechol ha-Torah hazos. And who else has such laws? Kechol ha-Torah hazos, in every detail, in all of its rigor. We say it every time we finish a Dvar Torah, So we run through it, but we don't really, sometimes we don't even appreciate the words. Rabbi Hananya ben Akasha Omer, Ratzah Kadosh Baruch Hu Lezakos es Yisrael. God wanted the best, what I would call, long-term result for the Jewish people. Lefikach, not Nasan Lahem Torah Mitzvos, but Lefikach Hirba Lahem Torah Mitzvos. More and more. In the immersion that we can all aspire to of Yahadus, again, not to go looking for shortcuts, but to try to figure out how we can make it easier for ourselves, not to take the approach of the Rasha, which is that it's really a tircha, it's something we want to avoid, but the approach of the Chacham is to say there are Eidos, there are Chukim, there are Mishpatim, there are so many Hilchos Karban Pesach, we need the whole night. There's so much to say about Yetzias Mitzrayim, we need the whole night. There's so much to say about Arami Ovid Avi, will be Mekayim the Rambam, Mosif Umarich. In appreciating and embracing the rigor and the totality of Yahadus' scope, indeed, we make the best possible impression. And just like a Rembrandt or a Brahms or a Beethoven, we basically tell our children that there is excellence. The product can truly be excellent if we're willing to put in the work. Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
I was in and out of the room selling chametz while this was going on, so I was very worried that I might repeat something that one of the other rabbis said, and I was thinking to myself, what should we do if it's awkward, if I start saying a Drash Torah, and you've all heard it all already tonight, so I just asked the Chazan, we'll sing Dayenu if I start, and that'll solve the problem. Covered Dayenu already, so we won't sing Dayenu. Okay, so two comments, I'll be very brief, the hour's late, two comments on Halach Ma'anya. The irony of the Haggadah is, of course, we call it the Seder, like it has this perfect structure, but when you look at the Haggadah, sometimes you realize it's a little bit more complicated, because there are styles in the Haggadah. There are things that are more pragmatic, there are things that are very basic on the surface, and then there are elements of the Haggadah that are very complex. There are certain parts of the Haggadah, you read them, you don't know why these psukim are in the Haggadah, it takes a little bit of a while to process, and then you have Rav Gamliel. There are three things you have to say tonight, A, B, C. It's as if it's perfectly clear, it's so simple, it makes perfect sense. So Halach Ma'anya is, I think, the best example of something that's extremely misleading. Because there are two great questions, and I hope two great answers to these questions about Halach Ma'anya. Halach Ma'anya, Yachla Vasana Bar de Mitzrayim, Kaldich Ben Yisivich. This is the bread that our families, that our forefathers ate in Egypt. And that itself is already confusing. Now you look at the matzah and say, this is what we're doing tonight. Well, did they eat it in Egypt, or did they eat it on the way out of Egypt? And you start to wonder with that question right away. Anyone who's hungry, come and eat. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has this amazing question. And he says as follows. You could describe matzah as the bread that they ate in Egypt, the poor man's bread, the bread of affliction, the bread of suffering. Or you could describe matzah as the bread that they ate in their first moments of freedom. You could describe it as either. Maybe both are true. The Haggadah in this paragraph chooses to describe matzah in the worst possible light. Halach Ma'anya. Now put it into the context. We're about to eat something terrible. That's what we learned in our shiur on Thursday night. Rabbi Yonah holds that way. Lechem oni means a poor man's bread. It has no taste. It has nothing to it. No texture, no sophistication. Flour and water. It's the kind of food you would eat if you were a slave. It's the kind of food you would eat if you had no money. It's the kind of food you would eat if you could not do any better. Anybody hungry? Kol dich ben yesev yechol. Open for business. Think about it. Rabbi Sacks is unbelievable. You describe the word. The only thing you could offer to a guest that would be worse is probably maror. You say, anybody who's hungry, come in and eat in poverty with me. Seems to be such a very bizarre gesture. So Rabbi Sacks' answer is profound, of course. And Rabbi Sacks says, it's the act of giving that really matters. When you're a slave, it doesn't matter. You can't give anything. You have nothing. That's what Chazal say, Masha kana eved kana rabo. Anything that a person, an eved, picks up immediately goes to his master. The eved has no possessions, he has no ownership, he has no power. And therefore, everything that he gets belongs to someone else. He can't give anything. It has nothing to do with what you're giving. The fact that a Jew is able to give to someone else is itself the most basic element of freedom possible. And that's exactly what he says we start with. Start by saying it's not about what we're serving, whether you eat roasted meat or you don't eat roasted meat. What matters is we're giving. And that is the first act of freedom that we do in the Seder. Ashkiach and Karen Biavner of Rivlin asked a different question, but also on the same notion. And this is, to me, when he asked this question the first time, it really struck me. Kol dech ben yesev yechol. Anyone who's hungry, come in and eat. When do we ask that question? Well, but more than that. We were talking between Mincha and Maariv before. You're not allowed to start your Seder before Tzeis HaKochavim. 8:16 on the first night, 8:17 on the second night. You can't start your Seder any earlier than that. So you go to shul, you don't talk to any new people, you don't invite anyone over for the Seder, you go home. You make sure everything is set up, you lock the door, you close the shades. Everyone you know, all of your family members have flown in from around the world. And then you say, if anyone's hungry, come on over. It's way late. Those of us who say hello in shul, so say hello and then say halach manya. Make an announcement, a hospitality announcement in shul. But that's not what we do. We make it around the table. So what could that possibly mean? So he answered, and I thought that this was very telling. We're not inviting guests from the outside, but we're sending an invitation to the people around our tables. How many people are there that end up at a Seder that they really didn't intend on being at? How many people are there that are at a Seder with family because you're supposed to be with family for Yom Tov, but it's not exactly the place you'd prefer to be? There's tension, there's unresolved issues. You're with people, but you don't feel like you're at home. And of course, Pesach is supposed to be, in its most basic element, Pesach is supposed to be a holiday for family. It's supposed to be a bias. Everybody comes together, we make one big happy family, and we celebrate the Korban Pesach together. You know, there's an interesting halacha on a Friday night or on a Shabbos day. If you're the man of the house, the woman of the house, and you usually make Kiddush, and you have a guest. So if you want to offer to the guest that they should make Kiddush, you know, you have a rabbi who's visiting, you want him to make Kiddush instead, so you can offer to him, you make Kiddush, not me. But the Shulchan Aruch says that's true for Kiddush, but not for Hamotzi. Hamotzi, the Baal Bais, makes for himself. Why? What's the difference, right? You know, if anything, Kiddush, you put the guy on the spot. If he's tone deaf, it's embarrassing. Hamotzi, everybody can slice a loaf of bread. So why is that? That Kiddush, you can pass off the kibbutz to somebody else, but Hamotzi, always make Hamotzi for yourselves. Exactly. So it's very practical, but it's also profound. Because you know how it is. Sometimes you want to save half a loaf of challah, put it back in the freezer. So you give it to a guest, and he doesn't exactly know how big the pieces are supposed to be. He doesn't know if you want the big slices, the small slices, or if you're one of those people that buys a pull-apart challah and still uses a knife for some reason. Nobody knows why. That's the job of the Baal HaBayis. He's in control. And we've all been there. You've been to Shabbos meals or Yontif meals where the host is a great host. And the hostess is a great hostess. There's never an awkward silence. Everything's taken care of, whether you intended to be there for Yontif or you didn't intend to be there for Shabbos. Either way, they make you feel like you're at home. That's a challenge. You're going to be around the Seder table with people who you knew you were going to be around the table with, and sometimes you'll have an extra person who joined in at the last second. Before the Seder begins, you say, Kol dich ben yesev yechol. Let's all do this together. Eino nechal ela limnuyav. The reason when you bring a Korban Pesach, you have to figure out exactly who's going to be part of your group. That's not so simple. Some people make the cut, some people don't make the cut. You have to kind of work together, and then you have a very meaningful Seder because you can do it as a group, as an entity, as a group together. Final thought. And I apologize to the Thursday night people, but I'm going to repeat this anyway because I fell in love with it this year. I always talk about charoses because I think charoses, different minhagim about charoses, are fascinating. And this year I got stuck on maror. How many kinds of matzah are there? Basically one. Maybe it's crunchier, maybe it's a little bit softer, maybe it's round, maybe it's square, but it's basically flour and water. How many kinds of maror are there? Show of hands, romaine lettuce people. Romaine lettuce? Horseradish? Jewish center people use horseradish. Okay, there you go, that's the victory. Okay, how many kinds of maror are there in the Mishnah? Many more. Why is that? why is it that there's basically only one recipe for matzah, but maror can be accomplished in many different ways? Anybody who was not at shir last Thursday night? Who was not at shir last Thursday night? Okay, that's profound.
We like to suffer.
One second, one at a time, one at a time. Yeah, you know, go ahead, head up.
Because there are many interpretations of why you have marble. And so, and this, yeah, it symbolizes a number.
In one sense, to me, marble is the simplest of all of the things that we do. Again, matzah has all these different themes to it. It's what they ate when they were in Mitzrayim, what they ate when they left Mitzrayim. The Karban Pesach has a symbolism. Maror is bitter.
It's a symbol of slavery, and there are very different kinds of slavery.
Okay. Okay. What I think the basic difference between matzah and maror is matzah is something they ate in Egypt, and maror is not. When you eat matzah at the Seder, they're both symbolic. They both get you in the mood. Chayiv Adam Liros Es Atzmo. They're both, everything's so demonstrative at the Seder, that's what makes it so appealing. The matzah they ate. I eat matzah because they ate matzah. Why do I eat maror? Rav Gamliel. The Hashabbos HaGadol Drasha is like the theme of the year. Remember what? Not the maror, the bitterness. So the eating of whatever vegetable you happen to choose is a tool. It's a vehicle. The matzah is not, it's not that some genius idea that someone thought of. They eat matzah, we eat matzah. Easy. Maror is a vehicle to get oneself in the mood of nerirus, of the experience of slavery. So if I eat something that reminds me of slavery, so that brings me closer to reliving the experience, not just talking about it, but feeling it to a certain extent. So what is maror? What does maror have to be? It has to be bitter. It doesn't have to be anything specific. Some things fit the criteria, some things don't fit the criteria, but it's not exactly the same as matzah, where if it's not matzah, it's not matzah. Maror, you have a range. Because it's not really about the chefta shel mitzvah, so to speak, but it's about the goal that it accomplishes. So what we were exploring on Thursday night was this business with horseradish. If you grew up in a house like mine, so then you have romaine lettuce for some, horseradish for others, and then the compromise was to have a little bit of both. And I think a lot of people nod their heads when I say that. I think it's very pervasive minhag. Now, why exactly is that? Why do people eat both? Shalom bais, very good, very good, very good. I think the reason what? Well, one second. Well, why do people eat both at the same time?
Well, in mixed families, you different kind of bread. Basically, in the Palestinian, you have root vegetables, and in other places, you don't.
Exactly. So what I always think about, what I always think about in this context is that people who eat romaine lettuce have, to a certain extent, a guilty conscience about eating it. Because when you go out to a restaurant and you buy yourself a salad in the middle of the year, you ask for the romaine. You don't want the iceberg, you want the romaine. You eat it all year long. Right? Everybody. And the real men at the table eat the horseradish. Because that's painful. Right? Is there a mitzvah to suffer when you eat maror?
No, it's the only time you get it.
When horseradish was first used for maror, it's not mentioned in the Mishnah, it's not mentioned by the Rishonim, it's not mentioned by the Gaonim. Horseradish isn't used until like maybe the end of the 14th century. And for very basic reasons. But when it was first used, the reaction was, well, that's not what maror is, right? You ask for a salad with a bitter green, so the greens balance out the sweetness of the fruit in the salad. That's bitter. What is horseradish? It's hot. That's not exactly merirus, that's harifus. Those are two different terms. There's a lot of opposition. A lot of opposition. Now, practically speaking, especially in Eastern Europe, it was true that in the season of Pesach, it was very difficult to get lettuce that we would use it for maror. So for practical reasons, it became very difficult to have it, and they naturally shifted from there to start using horseradish. It was a good second. There's this irony in this tshuva of the Chasam Sofer, where the Chasam Sofer writes, you cannot use romaine lettuce, you have to use horseradish, because people don't know how to wash their lettuce properly. That was a major turning point in the history of Pesach, because at the Leil HaSeder, the classic, the Gemara says of all the kinds of maror that exist, the Gemara in Arbei Pesachim says, the ideal is the romaine lettuce. Chasa is the best. And then it became almost universal, especially in Europe, that people were using horseradish. So why do I mention this whole story? There's much more to the literature here, but I just want to read one very powerful paragraph, and then I'll conclude. Question?
I always, when I have it, most does, I always think of this, the combined of them, as life, because life is bittersweet.
But what's the sweet? The romaine lettuce?
The sweet is the sweetness of, not when you put this, what are the good ones,
Oh, the charoses, yeah, the charoses. Well, don't eat too much charoses. You're not supposed to eat too much charoses. Yeah, that's. But we'll talk about that another time. But let me just conclude with this paragraph. There's an amazing article on this topic about the history of horseradish being used at the Seder, and the guy who wrote this article concludes with an unbelievable paragraph that I find it to be very inspiring. He writes, "The maror symbolizes not only the bitter bondage of Egypt, but also serves as a reminder of the bitter exile and the wanderings of the past and the present. How fitting it is that the symbol of this bitterness, which is horseradish, is in itself a product of these self-same wanderings. Even the celebration of the Seder has been so affected by the diaspora that commemorative symbols have become evidence and testimony. When you go back and you look at the history of the Seder, some things are pretty much the same. The matzah hasn't gotten better, it hasn't really gotten worse. In some cases, the matzah is hundreds of years old. It tastes the same. But the maror really has changed. The maror has changed depending on the region, depending on the country, depending on the climate. The maror has changed, and that's just a product. That's just a product of the Jews being in Gullus, and that adds to the bitterness of the experience. I was reading today, and I'll conclude with this. The Drashos Haran, the Ran has this interesting theory about the Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel. And he says, what exactly were they doing wrong? Why did God have to disperse them? They weren't doing anything. Everybody was worshiping idols. It's not like this was the turning point. And he says, the only thing that God feared, and this is really amazing, somebody living in Europe hundreds of years ago would write this. He says, the only thing God was worried about was that the world would actually become one entire country. And he says, as a people in Gullus, Jews understand that we are constantly wandering until we find ourselves a home. And there has to be options. There have to be democracies to leave and democracies to arrive at. There has to be places for the Jew to go, because when he's in Gullus, he's always on the move. And Mara really is reflected in that. And I think this year, when for the first time, because I saw these ideas this year for the first time, when I sit down to my Seder and I think about Mara and I see my father only with the horseradish and my mother only with the romaine and my brothers and my sister-in-law and et cetera, et cetera, I'll be thinking about that. Thinking about the places we've been, the experiences that we've had, and hopefully the places that we're headed to, that will be much more sweet than the maror that we eat. Chag Kasher v'Sameach.
I actually didn't bring a handout, but I brought this. Before everyone leaves, I'd just like to share with you a short song that I'm sure few of you have heard before. It's relatively one of the newer songs that we have on Leil HaSeder. There aren't that many new songs that have been written in the last couple of years. Most of the songs that we do go way back. It's for the text of the Hisham Dala Avoteinu Velanu, Shelo Echad Bilvad Amad Aleinu Lechaloteinu, Ela Shebechol Dor Vador, עומדים עלינו לחלוטנו, והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מידם. God saves us. And we're not afraid. And that's kind of, we see that throughout as a theme throughout the Seder. That at least at that night, we're not afraid. We open the door. We sit like kings. We're not afraid. And we know God's there for us. Please feel free to join in. And I encourage you all to use this at your Seder. It's a beautiful tune. Lie, 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 la 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 I'll do a little intro, that's optional for the Seder, but this song I recommend that you should definitely use. Shabbos Sameach, everyone.
Shabbos Sameach. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Thank you.